I did not envy Carl. I was so much freer than he was.
Both Mildred and Carl Wolfe were accomplished artists when they moved to Jackson, Mississippi in 1946. They had met at the Dixie Art Colony, fell in love, and later married in Colorado while Carl was stationed at Lowry Airfield during World War II. Both were celebrated within the greater art community, but prior to the move, Mildred had tasted national recognition. She had been exhibited at the Carnegie Institute and had her work featured in the Artists for Victory National Tour. She had fostered an identity for herself, completely independent of him.
The move, though, would reveal an awkward truth. The identity she built for herself in the art world did not exactly intersect with her identity as Carl Wolfe's wife in Jackson, Mississippi.
They got back here to Mississippi, and it was a different life for her. She had to deal with, and she had to deal with this for the whole, her whole married life here in Jackson, the people knowing of Carl Wolfe and knowing that she was an artist also, but assuming that she was the lesser artist. Mm. And she would have people say, you know, things like, oh, do you paint too? Well, he must have just taught you everything.
The question of merit would shift, unprovoked and needlessly, away from her attributes and qualifications as a painter and towards her connection to Carl and her role as a married middle-class woman.
I think it's just in the water, you know, this idea that you're supposed to fit into a specific profile, and that's a privilege. Not wanting to do that requires explanation over and over and over again.
Except that Mildred Wolfe wasn't really one for explanation. She possessed a healthy self-worth as an artist, and she knew she also had Carl's respect and admiration as both a contemporary and a wife. She might have had to exist within this world, but she certainly didn't have to succumb to it.
So I think my mother was, by nature, not at all interested in being in a social world that she had no affinity for, and just ignored it, really, basically. And like I said, she had some close friends who really understood her and valued her, and she loved being with. And the rest of the people, you know, she just didn't think about very much.
The guarded world she shared with Carl, and eventually her children, would converge with the peculiarities of polite Mississippi society. And the result of that juncture would be the Mildred Wolfe we know today, a curious fusion of Mildred the wife, Mildred the mother, and Mildred the artist.
Welcome to Four Freedoms. I'm Ryan Davis.
And I'm Michael Guidry.
Four Freedoms is brought to you in partnership with the Mississippi Museum of Art. Located in the heart of downtown Jackson, it is the largest art museum in the state and offers programming for patrons of all ages. And the best part, admission to the museum, its exhibitions, and its beautiful gardens is free. So check it out and visit www.msmuseumart.org for more info.
Chapter 3, Always an Artist. Throughout this episode, as it was with Chapter 2, you'll be hearing the words of Mildred Wolfe brought to life by Marie Venters. Again, these excerpts are possible through special permission by the University Press of Mississippi.
Our son Michael was born in 1946. We had an old-fashioned doctor who quite seriously said, "Now that you have this baby, you can stop painting and leave it all to Carl." I didn't argue with him, for it would have been hopeless. But he might as well have said, "You can stop being yourself and be someone else." I had always been an artist. Being a mother didn't change that.
She kind of quietly determined that she was going to have children, but she wasn't going to let it stop her. But that was very much in her mind. I think it was very much a struggle.
Within a year of moving to Jackson, Mildred gave birth to her and Carl's first child, Michael. And it's pretty clear by reading Mildred's words or talking to her daughter, Bebe, that while motherhood was another layer in Mildred Wolfe's identity, she was not about to let it be her sole qualifier.
You know, she really was quite a wonderful mother. But at the same time, she was very determined not to be just swallowed up in that role and that be her only purpose in life. And that took some, you know, real forceful determination, I think, back in those days, even in these days.
Those days, in this case, refers to the late 1940s through the 1960s. And when looking closely at the circumstances that shaped Mildred Wolfe's personal and professional life in Mississippi, it is important to understand exactly what that meant. Any historian or sociologist will tell you that there is a real density in studying this period. These are the most tumultuous decades of the civil rights movement, and Mississippi lay at the heart of that struggle. Underneath that, especially within the world Mildred was navigating, there was this staggering attempt to cling to antebellum gender expectations. Despite the strength that women across the country displayed on the home front during the war, the figure of the ingenue was still the venerated role for women in this polite society.
I think there's an incredible amount of pressure that women of today can't possibly understand to that extent. There are lots of other pressures, and things have changed, but the flexibility that women have to define their lives is vastly increased and much more complex than the 1950s.
This is Dr. Stephanie Rolfe. You've heard her voice in previous episodes, but she will be featured prominently in this chapter as we dive a little deeper into the roles of gender and, to some extent, race in mid-20th century Mississippi. But first, let's get back to Mildred and Carl. When the Wolves first got to Jackson, they rented a second-floor apartment out of an old-fashioned house on Park Avenue near Millsaps College. During those years, Carl maintained a studio downtown on Congress Street, which gave Mildred liberty to take a room on the north side of the apartment for hers. The location would prove to be convenient when Carl was offered a part-time position at the college. The campus also offered Mildred a quiet and safe place to spend time with Michael. It was where he learned to walk.
But soon the owners needed the whole house to themselves, and Mildred and Carl needed a new place to call home. They couldn't find anything they liked in town. Then Carl remembered a small patch of land just outside the city limits that he had purchased before the war. Before long, Carl and Mildred had transformed the property to suit their needs. First a studio for Carl, then a house. During the early years, Mildred was consigned to a corner of a bedroom with a north-facing window. Since Carl returned to her waiting clientele when they moved to Jackson, his work resumed steadily. Mildred did what she had always done, painted. She exhibited, won prizes, and sold some of her work. But there was a new factor in this otherwise conventional formula.
My father was a natural-born teacher and was always had something to say about something. And early on, she would poke his nose into our studio and make comments unsolicited. And she made it plain they had to have it out. She made it very plain to him that he was not to ever do that. He was welcome to make comments and they collaborate when she asked him to, but not unsolicited.
Mildred was principally acting on the advice of Kelly Fitzpatrick, one of the leaders of the Dixie Art Colony, who, by Mildred's account, had foreseen this dilemma. And she also recognized that when she did follow Carl's advice, it took away from her intentions as an artist. She needed that distance in what she described as the struggle for her own integrity as an artist.
They stuck to that, and I think he greatly respected her as an artist, so he learned pretty quick to leave her alone.
Two accomplished artists learning to coexist within this new dynamic, as a married couple, was bound to have its bumps. Like the time Mildred took Michael and Bibi to visit family in Decatur, only to return to find out that Carl had sold most of her paintings from her time in Colorado. Needless to say, this didn't go over well with Mildred. In her writings nearly 50 years later, she still describes a sense of infuriation over the incident. But he was sorry, and over time, a long time by her admission, she forgave him. Because, despite the stumbles, the thing that tied their bond, aside from love obviously, was respect.
That respect became the foundation of a world Mildred and Carl would create for themselves and their family on that quiet patch of land just beyond the city limits. It was a sanctuary that insulated them from the world that Carl served as a popular portraitist.
My parents both, and my father, as far as being the head of the household and the sort of tone setter for things, I suppose, back if you would think of it back then in those days, he was very bohemian and unconventional, and he was proud of it.
As a commissioned artist, Carl Wolfe had to serve in a world in which neither he nor Mildred fit. It was also a world they couldn't necessarily control. But the world they could control, that little oasis on Old Canton Road, is one Bibi remembers fondly.
They have created this little world that My father used to tell us that when we were really little children, he would make up stories about how he called us the alligators in the woods. And he would make up stories about the alligators in the woods and what they were, what we were up to, and how we were all artists and we were doing these really wonderful alligator things, and the rest of the world didn't understand. And so he really cultivated it. He really, made this world for us.
The rest of the world, especially that of white-collar Jackson, didn't understand. More specifically, they didn't understand Mildred Wolf. She wasn't from the same mold as many of her 1950s contemporaries. She was a trained technician, not some dilettante. Her identity was largely tied to her work.
These women artists were well-trained. They were not self-taught. They were professionally trained.
This is Betsy Bradley, director of the Mississippi Museum of Art.
They knew about the profession and having a career. It wasn't a hobby. It wasn't something they did, when they weren't busy with their families. It was their primary occupation.
And that is what set Mildred apart from her peers. Painting was not a hobby. It wasn't a vehicle for some philanthropic fulfillment. It was a passion and a livelihood.
Club women, thinking about the club women, and especially junior league women, they are positioned in a lot of ways, I think, migrates from, for those who had the privilege of going to college and maybe even working for a little while, it's expected to evolve into different kind of work, work that extends out of the home.
And my mother was like that. She's just like very down to earth and practical and able, and had no... She didn't have very much patience or respect for the helpless female role in any sort of way. It just wasn't her, wasn't who she was at all. But I think mostly from the outside world, people didn't understand her at all. She had several very close friends who did, who really got her. But I think the more conventional society of Jackson, really just total puzzlement, because she could be not intentionally, but she could be intimidating because she was sort of grave, and silent. She was not that kind of person at all, but people would just be nonplussed.
In a case like this, when a calm and widely accepted homogeny is disrupted, the disorientation can consume the group. Mississippi and much of the South would experience this phenomenon during the peak of the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. But at the forefront of this story, in a more personal way, Mildred was resisting the standardized ideal of what it meant to be a Mississippi woman.
The people around you often are asking you to justify their decision by asking you questions about why you're making yours. That somehow your decision for yourself is a disapproval of the life that they have chosen to live in.
In line with the rhythm of her life to this point, Mildred found solace in the things she held dearest. When she felt out of place at the schoolhouse in Coleman, there was comfort in the Dixie Art Colony. When she moved to Colorado and experienced unhappiness in her teaching situation there, she found relief in her partnership with Carl and the work she was passionate about. So in Jackson, as she resisted being pigeonholed based on her gender and marital status, she once again turned to her family of odd little alligators and her art.
We've spent a lot of time at the Mississippi Museum of Art throughout the making of this podcast. We've had the opportunity to explore the galleries and experience some of the amazing programming the museum has to offer. In fact, the museum offers a wide variety of year-round educational programs for both children and adults. First, there's Museum After Hours, a family-friendly cornucopia of art, social engagement, and education. Their Hoot and Holler Family Creation Lab brings 6 to 10-year-olds and their families into the galleries and classroom to look at and create art together. For kids 5 and under, there's Look and Learn with Hoot. It emphasizes creative play and literacy through story time and hands-on art activity. On top of that, each spring and fall, the museum hosts Family Day, a Saturday morning filled with art making, story time, music, dance, and games that all connect to the artwork in the gallery. To see a full schedule of these family-friendly events and classes, as well as a complete list of exhibitions, visit msmuseumart.org.
During the middle part of the 19th century, the timber industry began growing in the southeastern part of Mississippi known as the Pine Belt. Enterprising businessmen established mills along waterways like the Leaf River. One such man was Captain Benjamin Stevens, who opened a general store and timber operation in New Augusta. When major rail and dummy lines began popping up in eastern Mississippi to accommodate the booming timber industry, Stevens and his son decided to move the company to Richton. By the 1920s, the business belonged to the elder Stevens' grandson, Ben M. Stevens Sr., who managed a large general store as well as a successful timber operation. In April of 1926, on his way home from a business trip, Ben Stevens nearly crashed with a truck that was hauling peeled logs to Laurel. Mr. Stevens stopped to check on the driver, and after ensuring all were safe, struck up a conversation. During this conversation, he discovered that these logs were being delivered to a man named William Mason, who had developed a new method of making wallboard out of wood chips. He called the boards Masonite. The two men would foster a strong business relationship, and the B.M. Stevens Company would become the principal supplier of pulpwood to Masonite. Masonite boards turned out to be extremely popular, largely in part to their durability and wide range of applications. Masonite was used for doors, walls, and house siding. It was used for desktops and canoes, and it also made a great medium for oil-based paintings.
Back in Jackson, Mildred Wolfe was beginning to craft a professional identity for herself, but it didn't come easy being the wife of a prominent artist.
I think the times that she was irritated by all of it is when people would just assume that he had taught her everything, and people would say things like that. Or when people were surprised that she was an artist, sort of big surprise at your existence as a person.
But Mildred was an artist. That was a huge part of her existence. She found inspiration in the landscapes around her. A lot of her earliest work in Jackson captures Old Canton Road and the Wolf property. And she did it in a manner and style that became synonymous with her name.
So she began to paint this environment right here. This became a big subject of hers. It's just the views out of the window. And she presented these things in a really poetic and wonderful storytelling kind of way, but also this real joyousness of that moment, that moment that she was portraying, and that kept her endlessly busy.
This is a part of Mildred that Beebe affectionately remembers. It was the Mildred that strongly forged this link between the role she was playing, the role of mother and artist.
And that this is what I would see, I would grew up with this, sort of this production of work that would be like, wow, it's just amazing. Because her vision was so amazing that she saw things that way, that she wanted to portray things that way. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't literal. It was kind of, I think of it as kind of a magical realism.
Her ability to capture this magical realism is evident if you take the time to look at some of Mildred Wolfe's work from this period. In many ways, a piece simply titled The Old Studio beautifully summarizes the features Beebe mentions. It shows a modest building with white siding, aged and weathered. But the way she captures the sunlight striking the studio door is enchanting, like it's a portal welcoming you into another world.
This quality also allowed Mildred to carve into a niche Carl hadn't, children's portraiture. And it stands to reason. The clients seeking portraits from Carl Wolfe were patriarchs looking to encapsulate a moment in time where they were masters of their domain. Or they were ingenues, trapping their youth and beauty in oil and canvas. But children were different. They exhibited a joy that naturally fit into Mildred's intentions as an artist. She was able to start a portraiture trade of her own that, in some cases, included multiple generations.
Her work took on so many different mediums. She's known for memorializing a lot of people in portraits. Several of my husband's family members were painted by Mildred Wolfe. I have a tiny little piece I inherited from my mother-in-law. It's a scene of a courtyard garden, somebody peering out from a window.
Mildred Wolfe was already a contrarian in regard to her role as a wife and mother. As she worked to create a professional identity in Jackson independent of Carl, she also had to eliminate this notion of being a woman artist.
I think she thought of herself as an artist more than anything else, and I don't think she thought of herself as a woman artist. I think she just thought of herself as an artist. You know, in fact, I think she probably had an ambivalent feeling about being a woman artist.
Mildred Wolfe accepted the traditional feminine roles of wife and mother, but her identity as an artist transcended her gender. She was an artist, plain and simple. An artist's work is a reflection of her intentions, and she depends on the credit her work accumulates. But as the artist married to Carl Wolfe, this sometimes proved problematic.
And those times irritated her, you know, quite a lot. And also to have their work mixed up, to have her work attributed to him, which sometimes happened, you know, her actual work, that would sometimes really bug her to death.
Like the time Monsignor Chatham commissioned a series of panels for St. Richard's Catholic Church. Carl's students at Millsaps have been working on glass mosaics. One of those students did a narrow panel that depicted Christ in the shroud. The Monsignor liked it so much, he wanted all 14 stations done in a similar style for the newly built church across the street from the Wolfe's home. But the student couldn't commit to it. So Carl, who was greatly admired by Father Chatham, tried to convince Mildred to take up the project. The Monsignor, however, could not imagine Carl's wife being a legitimate artist. In fact, when he visited the studio, he caught eye of a double portrait of Michael and Bibi that Mildred had been working on. He mistook it for Carl's work, and was not so easily persuaded that Mildred possessed that ability. Eventually, Mildred would complete the commission to her and Father Chatham's delight. He ended up being so pleased with the panels, he also requested an altarpiece.
But this story, happy ending aside, serves as a reminder of the challenge Mildred faced when building her own merit and credibility alongside Carl.
She wrote once in her biographical stuff that she wrote, she said, I lived in Carl's shadow, but I never was his shadow. Mm-hmm. So she was aware of the disadvantages with which she had to deal but she didn't succumb to it. And she always made and sold paintings right alongside his portrait trade, was, you know, like I say, fairly prolific. So, you know, she had a constant trade of people who really liked her work, you know, just loved her work. And her work is really not like anybody else's. I mean, it's just had so much joy and heart in it. Just really quite wonderful.
This capacity to work and sell their art side by side brought them close to a family from southern Mississippi. Carl was commissioned to paint a portrait of a businessman who owned a general store in Richton. His wife was fascinated with the studio, especially Mildred's work. They were both so impressed that they asked her to paint a mural of oxen pulling a Lindsay wagon. Their family had a deep history in the logging business and wanted a painting celebrating that history for their general store. The man was Ben Stevens, and the next commission he offered Mildred Wolfe is the one that will bring our story full circle. Four Freedoms is brought to you by PK Media with the support from the Mississippi Museum of Art. It was researched by Michael Guidry and Ryan Davis, written by me, Michael Guidry, produced by Sonny Sway, editing and sound engineering by Ed Foose, original title score and composition by Steve Smith. It was recorded at PK Media Studios in Jackson, Mississippi. We would like to thank Marie Venters for lending her voice to give life to Mildred Wolfe's words. Excerpts featured in this episode were made possible through cooperation with the University Press of Mississippi. We would like to extend our deepest gratitude to Bibi Wolfe for her time and invaluable insight during the making of the series. We also encourage you to visit the Wolfe Studio on Old Canton Road in Jackson to experience and celebrate the artistic contributions of the entire Wolfe family. We would like to thank Dr. Stephanie Rolfe of Millsaps College and Betsy Bradley of the Mississippi Museum of Art for their contributions to this episode. For more information about this episode, visit fourfreedoms.pkpods.com. That's the number 4, freedoms.pkpods.com. To experience the Four Freedoms paintings in person, we encourage you to visit the Mississippi Museum of Art. Admission is free. Or visit their website, www.msmuseumart.org. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe through Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts for future episodes. If you want to support what we do, then please share, subscribe, and leave a review. That's all for now, but we look forward to further exploring the Four Freedoms with you in our concluding chapter.